Hey everybody, welcome back to Historians at the Movies podcast. I'm your host and creator, Jason Herbert, and every single week we are bringing you discussions about movies and the histories behind them. And this week, we're talking about 1995's 12 Monkeys, starring Bruce Willis and Brad Pitt and Madeline Stowe. And we're talking about the history of epidemic disease. And of course, we're all living in a world affected by COVID-19 some 3+ years later. So I wanted to invite on for you a scholar of epidemic disease, someone who talks about the history of epidemic diseases. And I'm talking about George Diener. He's an associate professor of history at Wichita State University. And he's actually also a former instructor of mine, a guy who actually turned me on to environmental history. So we're going to talk about George's hometown of Philadelphia, which figures prominently into this film. We're going to talk about 12 Monkeys. We're also going to talk about disease history and the historiography behind disease history, behind world history, behind environmental history. This is really a cool discussion to talk about really a heady subject. So I hope you enjoy this conversation. It was great to sit down and talk to George. He's one of my most favorite people in the entire world. I just love the man to death, and he is largely responsible for my career here. And I hope that you enjoy this conversation we have with him together. So sit back and relax, because 12 Monkeys is next on Historians of the Movies podcast. George Diener, what's going on, man?
Jason, thanks for having me on. This is very exciting.
Okay, so 12 Monkeys is a movie that I was familiar with, but I hadn't watched in forever. Oh. And then I had to go back and rewatch it the last, 2 days because I got really busy. And the whole time I was watching this movie going, what the fuck is going on? So I have so many questions for you getting into this thing. I'm gung-ho to talk about this movie and how it's totally not relevant at all to our current life. Let's just start. George, let's tell the audience where you're from and who you are and what you're doing here.
Okay, I am an associate professor of history at Wichita State University, a university you know very well as you spent quality time here. I am currently working on a Legionnaire's disease project. I have in the past worked on some flu projects. I have a book on public health response, influenza, and talking about public health response that came out with University of Pittsburgh Press. My publicist will be glad that I mentioned the names. And Global Flu and You, which is from Reaction Press. That one's sort of a more open-ended discussion of influenza. It goes further back. Currently plugging away at a manuscript that I have to finish by the summer to get set out for see if somebody will pick it up on Legionnaire's disease. So that's me, and I'm originally from Philadelphia, so this is why the movie's near and dear to my heart.
I have thoughts in Philadelphia because I just went to Philly for the first time in January at the
AHA. It's a wonderful city.
Is it, though? We're going to get into it in just a second. I suppose the audience should probably know you just alluded to something. You were actually the very first of my former professors to be on this podcast. So congratulations. Woo! You're also maybe the only former professor of mine to still talk to me or recognize me in public. So, I think that's kind of cool. And thank you for that. And of course, I went back to school much, much later on. I was an old grizzled man when I first met you at the age of, 30-something. Is that grizzled yet?
Feels no, grizzled you're a kid right at now. That age, believe me.
I know, right? Anyone younger than me, and I'm 46, is a kid who has no life experience whatsoever,
Exactly.
But you turned me on to Pilsners.
I brought them over to a party at your house.
Mm-hmm. And that was my going away party.
Yeah, they quickly disappeared.
They did not last long. So I thought about you when I went to Prague last year. I think I even messaged you when I was over there. Yes. I was like, hey, guess what? Yeah. And it was everything I ever hoped it would be. Have you been to Prague?
I have not. No. I went to Berlin and Munich summer a year ago, but I have not been to Prague.
It's a far better city than Philadelphia. I can promise you that. The beer is better. It's farther away from Jersey. I feel like that's one of the things going against Philadelphia is it's so close to Jersey. I've never been to New Jersey, and I've got that list of 50 states you know, that I want to go, that I want to be to. And I was in Philadelphia, right? Like I was downtown at the HA, maybe what, a mile and a half from the Jersey border. And I was like, nah, I don't care. I'm not going. I'm not, I don't need it. I don't need that much. I don't want to go to Jersey. If I want to go to Jersey, I'll just stay in South Florida.
You know, it's the Garden State, just so you know.
That doesn't imply goodness. Like, you could have a really shitty garden.
Yeah, there could be a lot of manure in that garden, is what you're saying.
You know what? We're already banned in Indiana, so I'm just going to keep this where it's at.
New Jersey on the list.
I'm sure there's some fine folks from New Jersey. I have fans at Princeton.
Oh, there you go.
A fan of Princeton. Maybe some people at Princeton. I don't know. It's all fine and good. But you also, I should actually be serious for a second, because you also like played this really key important role in actually my own development as a scholar, because the farther and farther I went, the more and more I turned towards environmental history, you know, as my work. And of course, I do indigenous and environmental, but, you know, I was coming in at Wichita State when I was there, talking about manhood and warfare and all fun stuff. And then I took some courses with you on environment. I took that Cuba course that you made me, like the Cuba readings course. And then I started dating Cuban women, and then that went horribly. So I have you to blame for that. I'm not to blame.
It's
but,
still wrong.
You know, I know, right? But it was, you know, it was a really important thing for me. Just, and I often think about that because you actually introduced me to maybe my favorite book, second favorite book ever, which is J.R. McNeil's, it was The Mosquito Empires.
I was going to guess Mosquito Empires. Absolutely.
Fucking love that book, man.
Yeah, fantastic and that, book.
It is. And it fits into today's discussion too, because it's very much a disease history related study, and it's funny, and it's about Cuba. But, you know, that was – God, I love that book. I've introduced that book to so many people, you know, since reading that.
You have as one of your questions that you prep us. I don't know if I'm spoiling it for the audience, but there are prepped questions like
– Oh, yes.
Here's what we're going to talk about, in which you have a list of books. And I have another John McNeil book on my list, not that one.
Oh, I bet I can guess which one it is.
All right. Well, when we get to it.
Okay. I know what it is.
You let me know if you guessed it.
I'm gonna write the magic word right here.
Write it down.
And then I'm not gonna show it to you just yet. Okay. So let's talk about this first and foremost. Since we're talking about the idea of environmental history, you know, a lot of things that I'm trying to do with this podcast is introduce maybe some different aspects of history. And I think maybe people are generally, you know, familiar with concepts, say like, you know, military history or gender history, maybe even labor history. But environmental history as a field is still fairly new, say, compared to some of these other things. So maybe we can kind of lay out what the idea of environmental history is and like why it matters.
So environmental history is kind of, you know, that explosion in the early to mid 60s of a flourishing of how historians do their inquiries, what they're interested in. And there was also in the latter 60s, there was a lot of interest in the environment as something that was being despoiled. And those two things kind of came together in the development of the field of environment. And it moved in the environment and landscape from something that's a background setting, you know, the scenery that history occurs against, into something that in itself is a matter of historical inquiry. So the field of environmental history, kind of its early days, is a story of despoilation, right? So this Edenic world is trammeled by European capitalists who, you know, do terrible things to the landscape. And over time, that sort of caricature almost has become much deeper and much richer in terms of inquiry. And so the field has expanded in a multitude of ways. Now, I come at it from the experience of a world historian, because my PhD is in world history. And so world and environmental were sort of parallel tracks that I was pursuing. And the thing that links them together is diseases. So disease in history kind of falls into both world and environmental. And it has been my experience in the field that environmental history and world history have really kind of started to meld in many ways, in which ideas are moving back and forth. And one of the, in addition to McNeil, one of the people that you and I had discussed previously about is my boy. Maybe McNeil's your boy, but my boy is Alfred Crosby. And so Crosby's work really has a foot in both worlds. And that's really where I come into this sort of thinking about environmental history is that sort of way that Crosby thinks about it.
Yeah, I mean, Alfred Crosby, when you break it down, for me, is maybe the single most influential person, because you just don't have a field of environmental history without him. I mean, someone that's going to come across it, right? There are too many amazing scholars. And there were some other folks coming out with some really cool stuff, including John McDill's dad was writing some stuff, you know, right around the same time, right? So it's not like it wouldn't have happened had Alfred Crosby not interjected himself. But, you know, I would tell you that, you know, in a lot of ways that – you know, and you actually assigned this book when I was your student there at Wichita State. And that was one of the books that really kind of got me thinking about the interplay. That, and along with J.R. McNeil's book, Mosquito Empires, really got me thinking about the idea of how the world affects human decisions. And then how, in turn, the human, you know, there's this very cyclical kind of thing going on where there's these feedback systems going on. But, you know, Crosby, I think, changes the game when you look at the historian's craft. I mean, it's the books that he writes are just too important. You know, the Columbian Exchange is just, it's not only the name of a book. It's at this point in time, it's a term we use, right?
You know, and I read Columbian Exchange after I read the first book I read from Crosby, which was Ecological Imperialism.
Probably even a better book.
Yeah. And Ecological Imperialism is kind of revisiting his arguments in the Columbian Exchange and making them, maybe refining them a bit, I suppose, because, you know, Columbian Exchange suggests things going back and forth somewhat in rough equanimity, but that's not the case. I mean, much of this relationship between the old world and the new, and, you know, the new worlds of the Pacific realm as well, is that this is a transfer. It's a type of imperialism that is transforming the landscape, transforming animals, and transforming disease regimes because of all these things that are interconnected. And it's really a fantastic book. And I first read that book when I was at, I did my master's at University of Denver, and I took a class with international relations guy, Arthur Gilbert. And we read that book in his class. And I'll never forget two things about that. One, what a great book it is. But two, how well Crosby writes. That is, you know, when you write, I like to think, you know, I try and do a good job writing effectively. And then I read stuff from Crosby and I'm like, damn, you know, he writes so well. Arthur Gilbert pointed this metaphor out, which I thought was a great metaphor. And he was talking about the Crusader kingdoms in the Mediterranean world. And because the diseases actually kind of ran against the Crusaders, because they were coming into a very similar disease environment, but one that had different malarial strains and different enteric diseases. So they didn't have an advantage coming from where they came from. That he said, the Crusader kingdoms melted away like a lump of sugar in hot tea. And I'm like, damn, that is just such a great metaphor to think about how this process would unfold.
I don't know if it's just it feels to me like almost like a generalism. The environmental writers themselves tend to just be so goddamn floral in their writing of all things. And I'm thinking, I was just talking about Dan Flores' work recently. He wrote Wild New World this year, which I think is the single best book I've ever read at this time. He's doing just amazing things. He actually just wrote a piece in Time today about the Environmental Protection Act, Endangered Species Act at 50. It's just an amazing piece. Jack Davis wrote The Gulf. And I don't know if you're familiar with that one, but the way some of these guys can write around the world. I remember when I was writing my dissertation, I would read their stuff in the morning and like have to stop, I'd have to put it away because I would start to write like them. And I was like, is this bad or good? Because me want write pretty. And I would get in these arguments with my advisor at the time at Minnesota. David did this amazing things where he knew when I was writing around an argument. Right. I would just be like, he's like, yeah, you're kind of bullshitting here because your writing got really, really, really pretty. I was like, I don't know. But these guys, I mean, Crosby's amazing. So if you haven't read Alfred Crosby's stuff, even now, it still feels, you know, I mean, obviously, like, you know, Columbian Exchange is a bit dated and it's just changed, but the writing, and it's still one of these, like, I can't imagine not assigning a work by Crosby in an environmental history course.
You know, and he's one of those figures that he's considered a founding figure in two subfields, right? So he's a founding figure in world history, and he's a founding figure in environmental history. So he clearly must have been doing something right. So,
well, he's made it onto this podcast. So,
there you go. And no residuals.
Yeah, I know. I know he's up in wherever it is in the afterlife somewhere being, yeah, I've made it. You know, it's HATM. Add that to the list of all the other, you know, acknowledgments and footnotes he's in like, you know, every other book. So
and you know, not necessarily pertinent to the discussion, but I met him a couple times and he was a super nice guy, too. That's like the cherry on top when somebody does things so well and they're just super nice guys. That's a good thing.
I always like to hear that someone is great, like as a person, because yeah, I've had this conversation with a few different people, and I kind of say this a lot, but you know, in this field, in history, right, we're surrounded by smart people. I always say that, you know, smart people don't impress me. Everybody around you has a PhD. That's not like a thing. What impresses me is kindness, you know, good people, because I know a lot of shitbags too. Anyway, let's talk about 12 Monkeys. Why, when I said, hey, let's do a pod, because I wanted, but mostly the thing was like, I just want to hang out. Like, I was like, really wanted to get George on the pod at some point in time. You know, I will tell you, I think I've told this before, so I hope I'm not embarrassing you this. Like, I've told people when I get these conversations about best lecturers I've ever seen, you are always at the very, very top of the list. And I have consciously modeled the way I lecture to students on your classes, because I TA'd for you a few times, I had you in class a few times. I hope I'm not embarrassing you, because I don't need an A from you now anymore. But, you know, I just...
I feel bad for your students if you're modeling yourself after me, but that's neither here nor there.
All right, let's talk about this. There are a ton of movies about diseases. There are a ton of movies about Philadelphia. Why did you pick this one of all?
Well, there's many things I like about it, and not least that I really like Terry Gilliam. So Terry Gilliam is a director. I really like his sort of journey through anti-fascism, which sort of underlies a lot of these stories. So you think about his movie Brazil, right? So poking fun at these sort of autocratic rule enforcing organizations and sort of puncturing their myth, because, you know, some of the businesses that they're all knowing and they're, you know, you're terrified because they're so efficient or whatever. And then when every autocratic government, they're so poorly run that they're a perfect fodder for farce. And Terry Gilliam can do farce like nobody's business. So that's part of it. But I've always liked the idea of, you know, maybe this is sort of underlying with the business of being a historian, that, you know, visiting the past and really immersing yourself in the past is something that's attractive to us as historians. I mean, if not, then we're clearly in the wrong business. And so this story, Bruce Willis goes back in time and, you know, in some ways, Bruce Willis is a historian, right? So he's going back in time. He's trying to find out information and he can't change it, right? So that's something that reappears through there is this has already happened. There's nothing I can do to change it, which is also sort of this notion of history that we're going back into the past to find information, not something we can change, but potentially that information could be useful, right, for us in the present. And so there's that aspect. Philadelphia is, you know, just it's something when I've often felt this way. And I guess I have a story. I'll tell a story of a regret of not having an opportunity to do something when I probably should have built it in. But my dissertation was on the swine flu program, which began in Philadelphia. And so when I was living in Philadelphia, I was very familiar with the landscape. Walking those same blocks was very helpful for me to understand and visualize the events that I was working through. And then my Legionnaires project, I worked in a little Jewish deli around the corner from the hotel where Legionnaires disease was discovered, the Bellevue Stratford. And so that was something that was underfoot, and it just for me helps me visualize the material you're working through to give it a setting. So those type of things. My regret is I went to Beijing at the World History Association conference in 2011, and I presented on a chapter in my second book in which I was drawing upon Hong Kong. You're at the university, you're getting a trip to Beijing. So it's not like you have a lot of money to spend on these things. So I didn't build the trip in to Hong Kong, which, you know, I wish I had, because my chapter on the events in Hong Kong in 1997 if I had that experience of walking those same areas, that it would help inform it for me. So thinking about Bruce Willis in Philadelphia, he's outside City Hall. I was very familiar with City Hall. Part of the material is in Wanamaker's, and it's at Christmas. And I remember as a child, one year I grew up in the burbs. We went into Wanamaker's for their Christmas show, and it's that very same angel that is part of the motif for it. So that sort of thing's triggering for me about the film as well. But the story itself is the idea of diseases and you know what they impact in terms of people and places and times have really fascinated me. And so here we have a case that they're driven underground because of the release of this ferocious disease. So all those things combined together. And plus, Bruce Willis is excellent. Brad Pitt is excellent. Madeleine Stowe is excellent. It's really just a really well done film on top of it. So not just its story, which I find engaging.
One of the things that's come to my mind as we watch these films now is how these films are also served as artifacts, right? And the film is, I think the movie comes out in 96. Futuristic scenes, I think, are supposed to take place in 2035 or some jazz, whatever. But, you know, you get so much of this idea when Bruce Willis is going back into first 1990 and then 95. I'm just looking around watching, okay, rotary phones, you know, yeah, connected to the wall. You know, what do insane asylums look like at this point in time? What does the city look like? Why are we being given this version of a city? So, you know, watching this in 95, I was probably a senior in high school, and I was having a historical moment myself going, oh, that was some time ago. That was, oh my God, that's coming on almost 30 years ago at this point in time.
And you're a kid. So let's bear that you're still a kid, but you're right. They do serve as artifacts of the time, and they also tell us something about how people see the world, right? And so they're receptive to this idea of an evil farmer. I don't want to give any spoilers, but
spoil a 30-year-old movie. Go ahead.
Evil pharmaceutical scientist. He's not evil. He's just a scientist working on this stuff, but he's creating a monster, and it's somewhat irresponsible that it gets out. Right. So there's somebody inside who purposely releases it. So that idea of science creating things and that they can escape, it's a concern at that time. It's a concern in the present day. I don't know if you're familiar with this book. Alison Young's Pandora's Gamble came out just last couple of years. She used to write for the Atlanta Constitution, did a lot of work with the CDC. So she's not a historian, but she writes on science. I'm not sure. I think she's independent now. But it's a book of catalog of laboratory mistakes. And some of them I was aware of, you know, just because of things that I'm interested in. Some of them I was not. And it's really it's alarming, the number of laboratory escapes and how they, you know, have caused little linkage of a few diseases, but the whole concept that these potentially awful disease entities could escape with relative frequency is enormously alarming. And so that too, this idea that science is creating something that can do devastation, and that sort of Prometheus idea that they're stealing the fire but they don't know what they're doing, right? Pandora's gamble is that it escapes from the box. So
the interesting thing is, this is not the only film that's coming out talking about this either. I want to say Outbreak comes out just about the exact same time with Dustin Hoffman. You've got these films that are dealing with these spreads of these epidemics, pandemics. What does this say about what we're thinking about in the mid-90s? And this, are you noticing like this general fear? And this is obviously well before COVID hits. And we'll talk about how we view this film through COVID, and maybe how we view COVID through this film. But what does it say about our concerns about the ends of the world? This isn't God. This is man causing the end of the world, right?
So there's two things. One, I'll circle back to. Remind me if I forget to talk about, you know, again, as part of that Beijing conference, there was a group of us sitting around with refreshing beverages, and we came up with a panel idea. So don't let me forget that. But let me Let me begin by talking about some of this is because the notion of control of disease, which was pretty widely held in the 60s and the 70s, began to fray. And one of those examples of its fraying is Legionnaires' disease. And of course, the nail in the coffin of that whole idea that we're on top of this stuff and understand all that stuff is the AIDS epidemic. Right. So that was something that kind of shifted the idea that diseases are something that we can control with modern medicine and they're not as big a concern to they've reemerged. Right. And so science and medicine doesn't know as much on these things as we had presumed them to do. And then, of course, as a spate of popular works, Outbreak came out, you know, the book on Ebola. And so these ideas, something coming back and creating misery, became much more something in the forefront, I think. And so in the late 80s, early 90s, you have this conceptualization of newly emerging and reemerging diseases, which kind of sweeps the whole discussion of understanding epidemic diseases is that there's new ones out there and they could pop up at any time. And ones that we thought we could control, like tuberculosis, have roared back, or syphilis has roared back in ways that demonstrate we don't have mastery over these things. And so that filters into popular culture and is manifest in movies and books and ideas that, you know, and ties again to the ideas that scientists are always creating dangerous things, which goes back to the atomic bomb, right? And maybe even before, if we want to go back to the mad scientist. But that reoccurring motif, which is just, it's not just a good vehicle for storytelling. It also, it's something that illustrates our fears as a society and people. And so I think those things coming together really played a role in this sort of spate of various sorts of stories. So here's a story from Beijing. So relatively young, I suppose, or younger, certainly younger in their career, professors sitting around and graduate students having a few beverages. You know, let's put together a panel. We put together an idea for a panel on zombies, which were just, at, you know, that time were becoming the big thing to talk about. Lots of, I don't know if Walking Dead was out yet or if it was coming out or whatever. But zombie movies and apocalyptic movies in general, they're environmental stories, right? Because you live in the city, some terrible outbreak, everybody in the city, you know, they're either hideously sick or terrible things are happening. So what do? You have to retreat to the countryside, go back to nature. And as you abandon the cities, nature recovers. We see it in the film we're talking about. You know, there's a lion, there's a grizzly bear, you know, the animals have recaptured control of the planet, were, you know, rendered to live underground. Zombie movies are their environment, you know, the old environmental story movies about how we have despoiled everything. And so we need to get back to nature. And this is sort of that nature's revenge in one form or another.
And I'm definitely thinking about films like I Am Legend is a perfect example right. of that when Will Smith is like hunting through and he's hunting deer in Times Square and stuff like that. And certainly World War Z especially is very, you know, as these are both zombie films spread. I mean, all zombie things are actually spread by disease, right? I mean, that's kind of key to the thing. However, I'm kind of wondering, right? This is almost anti-Crosbyan, right? Because one of the things that Alfred Crosby does so well is reinforce the idea that humans are animals, right? We are part of a larger ecosystem at play. And yet, we talk about some of these films by removing man from nature. Nature takes back over. But isn't man part of nature? I guess my bigger question here, George, is like, is there anything unnatural?
Well, so it's not unnatural, but if you think about a natural order, so you think about when any organism overpopulates its resources, right? You know, this is maybe a legend. I'm not a lemming expert, but presumably the story of lemmings growing to such numbers that there has to be some die-off, that population crash is about restoring the balance of nature, right? So you have the whole argument of overshoot that you're, you know, and which is also, by the way, a Crosby notion that these interlopers are introduced into new areas and they find resources and they grow exponentially and outstrip their resources, right? And so Eleanor Melville had a great book called Plague of Sheep, right?
Love that book.
Isn't that? And what love a great that title book. That is too, right?
I was citing that today.
Oh, great book. So that whole idea that, and also, and within that, great book, but I use as an example in some of my classes how, you know, how memory works, right? So the sheep have created something called the Valley of the Cactus, Val de Cactus, right? And the people who
live Mezquital.
Right. And the people who live there view this as it's always been like this. But it wasn't always like that. And it really wasn't even all that long before in historical time. It's about three generations, 75 years. When the Spaniards arrived, it was meadows and small patches of wood, and it was well watered. And then the sheep munched everything down, and they cut down all the trees and used that for mining and making plaster. And they transformed the landscape to something that it no longer suited what lived there before. And so now just cactus live there. So that idea, and a plague of sheep is just such a great title, that idea that overshoot requires a restoration of balance. And so these zombie movies have the idea that we have overshot here on the planet, and the planet is going to come back and rebalance things.
Right. We don't actually see a rebalancing of the human population in this film. This is a dark and desolate The Matrix had to be influenced by this film as I'm watching it, you know, especially with that dystopian future and all they're living underground and where it's warm. And I don't know why the ground is underground is so much safer than, I guess it's in the air is where this
that's the argument. That it's airborne.
Are there parts of this film that drove you nuts?
There is, and I'm going to tell you, this is one that every time I see it, I watch it far more often than you do, apparently. But when I see it, there's a scene where Madeline Stowe and Bruce Willis are in the cab, and they're going to the airport. And the cab driver, who has a New York accent, by the way, but that's neither here nor there, the cab driver says, the throughway is backed up. There's no throughways in Philadelphia. We have an expressway. If you want to say the Schuylkill, you want to say I-95, perfect. But throughway is New York. That's New York uses throughways. And so every time it's like fingernails on a blackboard for me when she says the throughway is backed up. But that's about the only thing I dislike about the film.
You know, I was watching it thinking like back in the – and you see this sometimes. I was just in an airport. Where was I? I was in Orlando a couple weeks ago. And the part where she goes right up to the counter and buys tickets in cash. Yeah. Like you could do that. You know, this is a pre-9/11 film.
They kept their shoes on.
Kept their shoes on. You could just go up and pay cash and say, I don't know where I want to go today. What sounds good? You know, We're going to go to Key. Here's the thing. No one flies to Key West. I mean, you can, but the plane is about 19 feet long. You know, the airport, the runway in Key West is about 25 feet long. No, you don't want to fly to Key West. You don't want to fly to Miami either, but flying to Miami is better. And then driving down to Key West, then making the harrowing journey down to Key West. I don't like that flight. That's all I'm saying.
Did you fly into Key West? Is this based on life experience or?
No, but can I tell you the single most harrowing flight I've ever had in my life is through Philadelphia. I was flying from Long Island, I think from into Philly during a snowstorm on like a 2-propeller turboprop thing. And we were rocking and rolling. I literally kissed the ground when I got. I'm not kidding. I was so terrified that we weren't going to make it. We thankfully missed our connecting flight because we flew from Philly to West Palm Beach, which that flight is like there's like 27 of those a day.
Little change in climate there too,
dude. I'm telling you, after that flight, I did not want to fly for years, and I don't like Philly's airport anyway. It's one of my least favorites.
The airport does like its appearance is not great, and it's pretty small and crowded. But there's some great food choices in that place. You have to find a cart that sells Philadelphia. Actually, now they have a little shop. Every time I go through there, I have to bring soft pretzels back here to Wichita because my family demands soft pretzels when I go anywhere through Philadelphia. So I have to build into my trip that I pick up a bag of pretzels to bring back here to Wichita.
Is that because native Kansans have yet to incorporate salt into their diets? You talk about a food desert. People of Kansas are great, and I really love Wichita, but
big hugs to me, though.
The one thing I'll say about Philly that I love was the food. Yeah. Good food town. Yeah. Really, really good food town. We were at the HA. What was it? There was that food court, that food area.
Oh, Reading Terminal Market.
Oh, my gosh. Yes, please. Yeah, all day long. That was outstanding. I was a big fan. And I did the when I was there, I went to the Rocky Steps
You should have gone in the art museum. It's fantastic.
I actually did go in the art museum, sir. I am a cultured guy. I have a master's degree from Wichita State. Thank you. So, you know, that's where my beloved art history. I remember I used to have this girlfriend from Denver, and I would first time we would go to we went to the Met in New York, and she was amazed that I liked the art.
Oh.
I was like, what? Do I give an impression that I'm that discultured? In fact, not only do I like art, I have a favorite art style. Give me Dutch Renaissance. I want ships. I want ships in shade. That's what I want. Like, you know those Dutch
portraits,
paintings?
You like portraits?
No. I mean, unless they're of me, you know? So, I mean, because I'm also, you know, a bit of a narcissist.
Nobody's noticed. So the MFA in Boston, Museum of Fine Arts, it's a really great art museum too, and they have a room of the Dutch master's portraits. And so they're just like, it's a pretty big room. They're all against the wall, and you walk in from one side. And I walked in, and there was a painting all the way across the room, and it just like, it glowed. And I'm like, wow. But I'm like, you know, I got to work my way around. And when I got up to it, it was a Rembrandt. I'm like, of course it's a Rembrandt. Of course. But walking into that room with all these great portraits, your eye was immediately drawn to the Rembrandt on the other side of the room. It just, it was luminous. The MFA is a really nice art museum too. But
Chicago's
can't go wrong with the Met. So. I have not been to a museum in Chicago. I have not.
Oh, I did like a summer in Chicago at the Newbery, and I was able to stay there. You know, as one does in Chicago for the summer, it was lovely. And I got to go to they have a bunch of art museums, and I forget the name of the formal name of the really good one, but I loved it. Oh my gosh. But Chicago's maybe my favorite city. It's good. And frankly, Minneapolis has an amazing art museum as well. So for those of you who are joining in now, we're just talking about pictures from here on out. So it's sorry. All right, let's talk about COVID. I feel like we can't talk about this film and not talk about COVID. It's too obvious. It's low-hanging fruit, but I also feel like when you look at certainly the paranoia around the recent pandemic and the shades of the idea that it was released, you know, in this film and things like that, I'm kind of wondering, let's talk about maybe 12 Monkeys through COVID and then also COVID through 12 Monkeys, I guess. So what are your thoughts on this?
The title actually is probably closer to how COVID jumped into the human population, that it came from an animal population, not 12 monkeys in particular, a bat almost certainly. But this idea, and there's two versions of it, right? So there's a conspiracy version that COVID was manufactured and released on purpose. That's a conspiracy theory. There's really nothing to support it, right? Aside from the usual things that support conspiracy theories.
Can I interject real fast?
Please do.
Well, no, I say this thing about conspiracy theories all the time, and I stole it from you, actually, which is the crazy thing about conspiracy theories is that everything has to go completely right, you know, in order for a conspiracy to work. It's why I hate conspiracy theories.
You're working with a branch of the government. Has it been your experience that the government has accurately predicted every set of events?
Well, now that the government listens exclusively to me alone, yes, absolutely. I'm sorry. All right, go ahead.
So that conspiracy theory is one thing, right, which would fit in with this idea that it's manufactured in a lab. But although I think the jury's still out, I know that some folks want to put it to bed, but I think the jury's still out. There certainly is a possibility that it could have been an accidental release, you know, not for nefarious aims, but working with this particular organism, this virus, escaped. It's not implausible that that could happen. So thinking about an institute that's busily going about their work, you know, as Pandora's Gamble shows, these laboratory releases happen all around the world. The CDC had a spate of bad releases and bad series of events. So even the places you would consider gold star laboratories have the opportunity to release these things accidentally. I mean, they're just they're clever organisms. Their only goal is to infect another person and continue their chain of transmission. So they don't have agency, but they have you know, a lot of tactics. And if you think about infectious diseases in general, it's just amazing the things that have evolved to allow these organisms to infect new people and continue to spread. So it's not impossible that it was accidentally released from a laboratory doing work on it, right? So at any rate, we don't need somebody, as you see in 12 Monkeys, somebody who's booking a flight and going to 12 major cities around the world, right? He's flying from Philadelphia to San Francisco to, you know, Mumbai. I mean, he flies all over the place to, you know, releasing this virus. It's not necessary. We're so interconnected that it travels rapidly without any aid, just the way that the world works today. We're so interconnected. I suppose, you know, in those elements, it's not necessary for something like that to spread. It's just that if it gets out and starts infecting people and has an aptitude to infect people, it'll get around. That's the unfortunate part about these infectious diseases.
You know, I was watching this and it was just, I can't see this film without thinking about the disease. And of course, I don't really think that, you know, in 2023, I can really do anything right now without thinking about the disease. And maybe in some ways this kind of offers an opportunity to reflect on maybe some other diseases in history. Specifically, I want to talk about influenza. You've written on influenza. We actually see World War I in this film as well, which I couldn't help but think about, quote unquote, Spanish flu, which we know is not Spanish.
But it is flu.
You know, it also, you know, it offers an opportunity to wonder what it was like for people coming out of, say, Spanish flu or the plague or things like that. How long is it before people kind of go back to normal? Is there a normal ever again? You know, how that disease or the memories, frankly, of that disease still shape what it is that we do consciously or subconsciously, you know, today. So it's flu season. Can we talk about the flu? Because I was going to originally ask you, it's like, how has disease shaped human history? It's like, we don't have that kind of time today. But maybe we could talk about influenza. You've written on it extensively. We see, like I said, we see the World War I in this film, so it's an opportunity to talk about the flu and whether or not people have gotten their shot yet. I have not gotten my shot in my mother's.
Ah, get your shot.
I'm working. We don't have Publix here in Colorado. I could go get my shot at Publix down in Florida. Here it's, I don't want to eat the food in Colorado anyway or go to the grocery because all we have is like Albertsons or this this other weird place. I forget what it's called. Okay, what's the grocery here?
King Supers.
Yeah, that's awful. It's just terrible. Don't sponsor us, King Supers. I will not reject their money, but I'm not liking them right now. So let's talk about – can we talk about the influenza itself? Is influenza a new disease? Has it been with us throughout human history? What's up with influenza and you?
So – influenza is it's a crowd disease, right? Because it spreads through crowds, it's respiratory. So to a certain extent, to keep it going in a human population, you got to have a crowd, right? So that's something that that factors into how old it is. But it's actually a bird disease. Here's a little bit of my Philly coming through. One year, my honor students gave me grief about this. It's an aquatic waterfowl. So my tell with my Philadelphia background is water, right? Mm. And so I had an honors course. We were doing epidemics and we were doing flu because that's what I was researching at the time. And about halfway through the semester, the student said, "Oh, you're talking about ducks and geese." And I go, "Yeah, waterfowl." He goes, "I've been trying to figure out what waterfowl are." So it's a bird disease, right? And it's been in birds for hundreds of thousands of years, unknown how far back it goes. Although these are wonderful times for people interested in diseases and history because of what science is doing. But we don't know how far back it goes, but it's been in those populations for who knows how long. And it doesn't, in those populations, bird populations, ducks, geese, it's not in a part of stasis, but it doesn't really change much in those bird populations because the incremental changes really don't give it much of a competitive advantage. When a bird has, when a waterfowl, not chickens or something different, but when a duck or a goose has influenza, they get, some ruffled feathers and they eat a little bit less, but they go around doing what birds do and they fly around and they crap out this stuff. Yeah, because it's an enteric disease for birds. And it, it's in some ways an amazing organism. You can extract viable influenza virus from cold water lakes where the birds overwinter up to 2 weeks after the flocks have left. So there'll still be viable influenza virus in there. And so almost all the ducks and geese in the flocks will contract it, but it doesn't give them any troubles, right? It has to go through a process to become a human disease. So we're concerned about flu because it infects people every year, but it's a bird disease. And so when it gets into the human population, there's oftentimes a step in between that changes the organism. Some of it is through mutation. Some of it is a swapping of genetic parts. And if you're really interested, I can give you the whole story about how that works. But the simple version is this is an organism that needs crowds of humans in order to continue transmission. And periodically, something emerges that is so different that nobody has any immunity to it. And so because it's a highly mutable disease, it's an RNA virus that spits out a lot of mutations, over a course of a flu season, it changes subtly, its outside shape. And as it changes that, technically the mixture of hemagglutinin and neuraminidase proteins on the surface of the virus, as those change, your body no longer identifies it with antibodies. So then those incremental changes allow it to keep transmitting. But periodically, there's going to be a mixture of different flu viruses that produce a markedly different virus. And that one nobody has immunity to. And that's what causes pandemics. Over the course of a season, the yearly change of the virus is why every year you need to get a new flu shot, get your flu shot. Pandemics are something that nobody has immunity to. And so because it's a very efficient transmitter, it rapidly circles the globe, which is what happened with Spanish flu. Spanish flu is a completely new virus. Research into it suggests that it's mostly bird. It was something that wasn't well developed for the human population, but it became very human transmissible. And when it did, Spanish flu is marked by 3 or 4 waves of Spanish flu. And it's really the second wave that takes off in August that is the killer wave. That's the one that is responsible for the lion's share of the mortality from it. And it moved really rapidly. So we were talking about transmission with, COVID didn't need somebody seeding the planet with it. It's just its own innate ability to transit from person to person that allows it to circle the globe. Well, Spanish flu circled the globe as well. And Crosby wrote a book on Spanish flu, reissued as the Forgotten Pandemic. So we'll talk a little bit about forgetting as well. But that flu was infecting people in Seward's Peninsula in the Arctic, brought there by dog sled, at the same time that the headwaters of the Gambia, brought there by canoe, was infecting people. And this same organism, the same virus, was killing people in the Gambia and the Arctic at the same time because it's such an efficient transmitter. It's remarkable. My interest in world history, the world history program at Northeastern, when I was there, really focused on connections. Well, diseases bring in a high relief connections. You wouldn't think the Gambia and Seward Peninsula are connected into the same system. And then you have everybody suffering from Spanish flu at the same time. And lo and behold, we are all connected, right? And so that aspect of pandemics you know, in addition to the impact they have, the mortality somewhere, best guess is somewhere between 40 and 50 million people globally died of Spanish flu. That aspect of it, there's also things that are related to it. So we're connected in ways in 1918 that you wouldn't necessarily have thought about. And that's true in 2023, perhaps even faster and more so than ever before.
Yeah. You know, one of the things that kind of has maybe surprised me coming out of COVID, and I hate to say coming out of COVID because we're still dealing with it, and I certainly don't mean to suggest that it's over. I think so many of us have lost a lot from that. Everyone's been touched by this thing. But I remember during the time thinking, okay, things have changed. Things have changed forever now. Things are different. And we're back a couple short years later, 2023. People are blowing on birthday cakes again. You know, I haven't worn a mask in some time. I mean, I was religious. I went 15 months without, you know, going anywhere. Because I was so afraid to spread it. I wasn't worried about something happening to me. That never really bothered me. But the idea that I might inadvertently hurt somebody else certainly scared me, you know? But it feels like we're kind of back in so many – you're talking about the idea of forgetting. I was hoping maybe you could kind of expand on this idea. Like, what do you mean when you're talking about that? I mean, because it feels like we've kind of forgotten.
Yeah. So Crosby referred to it as the forgotten pandemic. And it's really true on an institutional sense. Congress allocated $1 million in 1918 money to study flu, to build hospitals, to build research centers. As soon as the pandemic was over, that money evaporated. There was research done to identify that it's caused by a virus. They didn't understand it was caused by a virus at the outset of Spanish flu, that is assumed to be a bacteria. But they eventually discovered the idea of it being a virus. But the way that was funded was a British research institute was repurposing money from distemper studies. And they thought they could use this study as a way to take a look at, you know, other viruses that transmit. And so they discovered that inadvertently that an illness that was infecting ferrets was influenza, because they were able, you know, the people with influenza infected the ferrets, and then the ferrets actually sneezed into the face of a laboratory worker and transmitted it back, and then he got the flu, right? So that research was funded because some wealthy dog owners who read a journal called The Field, a perfect British identity, right? It's a journal called The Field, and it's about hunting dogs, right? So the wealthy people concerned about their hunting dogs wanted to, you know, find some sort of cure for distemper. And so they repurposed some of that money, and that's how they discovered flu as a virus, right? There wasn't research into it. And, you know, there wasn't a lot of attention paid to it until World War II started looming. And then the military remembered very well that the impact of the flu on activities in World War I. In October, they cut troop transports from the United States by 10%. That impacts the business of war. And so, you know, the military became concerned about flu again. But it's remarkable that at the institutional level, there was this forgetting, not at the personal level. Everybody had somebody in their family that had either died or been adversely impacted. And those stories were very powerful. I'll give you two examples. In 1976, when there was concern about the swine flu, there was a meeting of scientific advisors for the head of HEW. And they were sitting around this room and they were talking about, you know, this potential new flu strain related to Spanish flu. And they all had stories about people in their families, right? What had happened. And those stories were very powerful. The one chief scientific advisor said his father was a doctor in Hershey, Pennsylvania, and they had to bury the bodies with a bulldozer, right? So that's a very powerful memory that was not forgotten, right? It existed. And now when I first came here to Kansas and was talking about flu, you know, you give talks to libraries and other places, older people would come up to me and tell me their stories about their mother, their uncle, or some family member who died or whatever from Spanish flu, and it was very real to them. So in that sense, it wasn't forgotten. But at the institutional sense, it very much was forgotten.
How's Legionnaire's disease compared to the flu? Because you're working on this new project now. I never even heard about Legionnaire's disease until you told me to watch like the celery at the grocery store, being the water coming down. I was like, you've ruined dinner for me, George.
Only one case.
You're like, watch the water come down on the celery.
Yeah, the mister throws out water droplets in the perfect size for deep inhalation.
Yeah. So what is Legionnaire's disease? What does this do?
So Legionnaire's disease, it's an environmental source disease. It's a bacteria that grows in either poorly maintained or even if properly maintained, if something goes awry, it replicates and it becomes aerosolized and you can inhale it. And there was an outbreak in Philadelphia in 1976. It's called Legionnaire's disease because the Pennsylvania chapter of the American Legion were having their annual convention at the Bellevue Stratford. It's funny, I was 10 at that time. I was 10 in 1976. And I remember Legionnaire's disease because it was all over the newspaper. It was a big deal. But oddly enough, same year, 1976, was swine flu, which was March of 1976. I don't remember that in the newspapers at that time. But I do remember Legionnaire's disease and being very concerned because ultimately 186 people contracted it. There were two dozen or so deaths and lots of people very sick and all that aspect. But nobody could identify it. And that's what was really alarming. And then what became even more alarming when they did identify it was that they found a bacteria. One of the things, fortunately, I've been able to do as part of the areas that I've been working on is that a lot of these people are still around. And so I've done some oral histories and interviews with these folks. First off, they are amazingly gracious with their time. The people who were involved in scientific research and public health in the 1970s, unfailingly, both on flu and Legionnaire's disease, with one exception, and I won't throw this individual under the bus, unlike you.
That's what we do here.
But it's one exception. Everybody has been very gracious with their time. And I was interviewing someone who was, there's a part of the CDC called the Epidemic Intelligence Service. And the way it works is it's a two-year program. They give them a crash course in epidemiology, and then they distribute them around the country. Some of them work with public health departments, like in Philadelphia, and others are sent around on outbreaks, and they do outbreak investigations. And so this guy, Ted Tsai, was one of the first three sent to Philadelphia or sent to Pennsylvania to investigate the Legionnaire's outbreak. And he said, and he went on, all these guys went on to, you know, long, amazing careers in public health. And he said, you know, if it was a virus, it would have been okay, right? That would be expected, something like that. But he goes, a bacteria was just so completely unexpected because it's not in like, you know, the rainforest somewhere or, you know, some deep ocean trench or something that people aren't there. It's in the middle of, at the time, the fourth largest city in the nation, which had one of the top medical infrastructure systems in the world, and nobody could find it. Nobody knew what it was. They couldn't visualize it. And it was something so big that when they found a way when they uncovered it and visualize it, you can see it through a microscope. I mean, you had to stain it the right way, but it's not something that, you know, was impossible to find. And here it is right in the middle of Philadelphia. And then when they found it all around the world. It was causing pneumonias, outbreaks, killing folks all around the planet. And we never knew it was there. It was just, you know, when people go to the hospital with pneumonia, and they can't identify it right off. They say it's unidentified pneumonia. Well, some percentage of them were Legionnaires and had been killing people for who knows how long, right? Part of it is the modern world is a perfect environment for it. I wrote an article for Environmental History that suggested it's a perfect environment for this organism because it likes warm water. And so we surround ourselves with things for our comfort. So we have air conditioning systems that have heat exchangers that use water to remove the heat so that we can cool the building. And we have, you know, produce misters, right? Only one case associated with, so I don't want to scare people off of produce, but then you have hot tubs, right? Or spas or anything that we like nice warm temperatures around us, or we like to have cooler temperatures and we have to move that heat. All those things are perfect venues for this organism to flourish. For me, that aspect that it's something that was unidentified at the time really struck me as a useful thing to spend some time researching, but also thinking about in this longer term discussion about, we had this idea that we had mastered the disease, right? And then here comes Legionnaire's disease. And I mean, it had to shake the scientific and medical world, right? Because it's not something that was hard or rare. It was right under our noses the whole time, and nobody could identify it. And then you have other, in this time in the 70s, you know, thinking back to this, let's say the late 50s into the 60s, the epidemic diseases were a matter of logistics, right? We have the cures for them. We have antibiotics. We have vaccines. We can do all these things to protect us against infectious diseases. It's just a matter of getting them to everybody, right? So it's a matter of logistics. Well, this idea of Legionnaire's disease and toxic shock syndrome, and then talking about AIDS and Ebola. Ebola also appeared in 1976. These things that are coming from the world around us, we don't understand. We don't know. We haven't mastered. And so that changed the whole paradigm of understanding with epidemic and infectious diseases. So that's what I find really useful to think about in terms of Legionnaire's disease. This is like one of those first clear signals that the old model doesn't fit the world we actually inhabit.
You know, I just keep thinking now about smallpox. I just wonder if defeating smallpox gave us this false sense of security, this idea that, do anything, right?
It's an amazing feat.
Yeah, but it's one disease. There's a whole bunch of them.
Yeah.
You know? I'm wondering, actually, and I hadn't prepped you on this, but I'm wondering how climate change is affecting, you know, we're talking now about like this warm water with Legionnaire's disease, things like that. Climate change is affecting us on so many different levels. It's hard to comprehend how many facets, and I don't even know that we're conscious of all of them right now. But is climate change having an effect on disease transmission and spread as well?
Sure, absolutely. So malaria is going to be moving into new areas because
that's something to look forward to.
Yeah, something to look forward to because of that. So thinking about something like Zika, right? So Zika is spread by mosquitoes. Transportation got Zika from one spot to another. And when it got into a mosquito population in a new place, Brazil, and then later the Americas up to Puerto Rico, up into Central America and even lower South America, lower United States, North America, and North America with Mexico, the mosquitoes spread it around. So the longer the range of mosquitoes, plus the fact that warmer temperatures allow for longer breeding periods for mosquitoes, and they also warmer temperatures, mosquitoes are more active. All those things are bad, right? And so one of the things that is sort of a reoccurring motif in many environmental history stories is the law of unintended consequences. So we remove an organism from an ecosystem because we think we know what's going to happen, and then something else happens entirely, completely unexpected. Some new input is brought in, and it sets off a cascade of changes that aren't anticipated, right? Thinking back to Silent Spring, right? So we have this new chemical that, you know, it kills all these mosquitoes and other pests and all those things, but we had no idea about biomagnification, that it accumulates through the food chain and then reaches levels where now the eagle's eggs are all breaking, right? And so the law, it's a reoccurring story that we set in change motion for complex systems that we do not understand. It's sort of like conspiracy theories, why conspiracy theories can't work. you never anticipate everything. You can't anticipate everything that's going to happen. So the more complex a conspiracy theory gets, the harder it is for it actually to work. So this is kind of the inverse. The more complex system and ecosystems are enormously intertwined and connected in ways that we don't fully understand, pulling parts of that ecosystem around sets off changes that we just don't anticipate. And so then we say, oh, well, yeah, I guess that didn't work out so well. So
the spread of disease is obviously key to what sets this film off entirely. We kind of talked a little bit about zombie movies a little bit earlier, about Outbreak. What are the movies you got when you talk about your favorite film? What's your favorite films where people get sick? What do you got?
Well, my favorite film for that is Contagion. Fantastic movie. And not only a fantastic movie just on its own merits, again, like 12 Monkeys is a great movie on its own merits, but the accuracy of events in Contagion is amazing. And it, I know they filmed part of it at the CDC, and I believe it was a WHO epidemiologist who was a consultant on the film. So the epidemiology and how these things unfold, yeah, they're pretty much on track. And, you know, they fictionalized the causative agent, but there was an outbreak associated with exactly that organism. Nipah virus happened in the way it caused those, that sort of encephalitis, that brain swelling, that it came from a pig that a butcher was working on, was one of the outbreaks. So that outbreak story, you know, they fictionalize it because then it becomes highly transmissible. And Nipah virus, fortunately, is not highly transmissible. But that origin story is spot on, right? And so seeing how those things link together in the world is really – and then the societal impact, right? So we didn't have anything as completely dire as what goes on in Contagion. But you can see that there was some fraying in societal aspects under COVID. So some elements about I often think about these things in terms of the fragility of our system, right? So drawing upon a metaphor, I still haven't said the book yet, but a metaphor.
Well, I've got the book right here.
A metaphor from that the book I was referencing earlier is humans as a species are very rat-like. We're very adaptable. We're very able to survive lots of things. But human society is very shark-like. It is supremely adapted to a certain set of circumstances. But if those circumstances change, it's going to be really hard for that organism, a shark, to continue in the way it has for 100 million years, right? The metaphor of that refers to our use of energy. But I think of it in terms of how society operates. It's more fragile than we like to think about, I think.
You might be referring to, George, a human web.
I am not referring to a human web.
Are you referring to something new under the sun?
I am referring to something new under the sun. Yes. Excellent work. Marvelous.
For those of you who have not read your John McNeil. You threw me off for a second when you were talking. We started talking about the chain and connections. I was like, is he going web on me? Because my first thought was, I know you love something new under the sun. I think I have every book John McNeil's written. Yeah. But yeah, all right. Let me ask you. Okay, so now we're talking about books. Fuck it. Yeah.
And John McNeil also a super nice guy.
Yeah, he's funny too. His writing makes me laugh. Like, there's that great line in Mosquito Empires where he's talking about this dude, this king who is suffering and he's going through all of these treatments and he says he just finally had the good sense to die. You know, it's like, it's one of the few history books I've actually gone outside and actually laughed about. All right, let's talk about this. For people who are new to disease history or environmental history, what are some books you dig? What's out there that you like?
Well, everything has a story, right? So I'm going to tell you the story of some of how I came to my particular interest in disease history. So I did my undergrad at Temple University in the finest city of the land, Philadelphia. And at Temple University, I was in a lecture hall, and the professor, you know, as you mention books while you're doing other stuff, right? You're doing your lecture, you're talking about something, and you reference another book. So you give the name because that's what we do, right? And so this professor mentioned a book called Rats, Lice, and History. Just, you know, part of the discussion as an aside, referencing it. And I thought,
this is not a book you mentioned on a date.
Right, exactly. Well, some dates are different, right?
I guess.
You're trying to end the date, right?
If you're dating in Philadelphia, maybe, but go on.
Maybe so. There's more than a few rats there. So he mentioned that book, and I was like, wow, that sounds like a pretty cool title. So I went to the library. Now, the backstory has a backstory. At the time, my bill was not fully paid. So Temple suspended my library privileges to incentivize me to come up with the rest of my bill. So I couldn't check the book out. So I sat on, you know, one of the tables in there, like, for a couple days straight. I'd go and read for a while, and then I'd go off to class. And I actually commuted into the city, so it depended on my school schedule. But I read that book in the library as an undergrad, and it really kind of stuck with me. It's been referred to, and I like this description, a whimsical biography of typhus. And it's about how he, you know, Hans Zinsner was a bacteriologist for the aficionados of scientific nomenclature, Hans Zinsner disease, or Brill's-Zinsner disease. He's the Zinsner in the name. So he's a bacteriologist who studied typhus in the early 20th century. This book came out in 1934. And it's about, he tried to go back and find typhus accounts in history and what its impact was. And sometimes he found typhus, you know, according to descriptions, and sometimes he didn't. But he found diseases and how they impacted events and shifted history. So I read that book, and it's kind of in the back of my mind. Then the second one we mentioned, Crosby's Ecological Imperialism, thought about that book when I was in my master's program, University of Denver, right? So I came across that. At the time, much like you, I was pursuing something different. I was pursuing 20th century U.S. foreign policy. That's really what I was interested in. And still remain an interest in, but that's what I was seeking to pursue. And so when I moved to Boston, deciding I wanted to go to a PhD program somewhere in Boston, I ended up going to talk to the man who became my advisor, who was the graduate advisor at that time, Tony Penna. And I went and talked to Tony, and he said, look, our program is a world history program. It's a little different. He goes, if you're looking to do 20th century U.S., this isn't a program for you. So thinking about that, he goes, but he said, if you can think about approaching history a little different, maybe thinking about how events in history are different than just governments and things like that, then he goes, then this would be a good program for you. And so I had in my mind thinking about rats, lice, and history, and thinking about ecological imperialism, and thinking about disease and the world and environments. And so I kind of moved to go to Northeastern and do that. And so that introduced me to, you know, the literature on diseases in history in ways that I hadn't formally thought about before. And so starting to think about it formally brought me to John McNeill's father, William McNeill's Plagues and Peoples, which also, even before that, his book in the 50s, that came out in 1976. But his book in the 50s, The Rise of the West, in which there are disease and environmental elements in that book introduced into the, you know, what was the usual way of thinking about, you know, European rise and other things. But there's elements are there. But Plagues and Peoples systematically introduced the idea of disease, not as something that's in the background, a sideshow, but as one of the drivers of human history, right? And so that really appealed to me. And so along those lines in my doctoral program, I read John McNeill's Something New Under the Sun. He came and spoke at Northeastern, or he came and spoke at the, wasn't Northeastern, or was at the Massachusetts Historical Society, which is right down the road from Northeastern. Fantastic place. Second oldest historical society in the nation. Great place. If you're ever in Boston, it's really a fantastic resource as an archival site. And my experience there, the people were fantastic. So Something New Under the Sun. Tony said, you know, I was a doctoral student at the time, goes, you know, I was going to the talk and goes, do you want to go to dinner with us? I'm like, yeah.
Yes,
absolutely.
I do.
So I sat and, you know, Tony and John were talking about books and, you know, the publication business, which was eye-opening for me. They were talking about how many books they sold. And I was like, wait a minute, that book was reviewed in the New York Times and you've only sold that many? He goes, yep.
Mm-hmm.
So, but he has two, he had two great teaching examples that I utilized a lot. One was prior to the Neolithic Revolution, there were probably more baboons on the planet than people. So thinking about the impact of the Neolithic Revolution, we were outnumbered by baboons, but because of that world that was created from the Neolithic Revolution, now there's 8 billion of us, and there's not 8 billion baboons.
I've never thought about the baboon-human ratio before, but yeah. now that's in my head.
But now, yeah, but thinking about, I mean, illustrating the Neolithic Revolution, what a great teaching example. The other one, which is also another great example, in his discussion about energy, the average bulldozer driver or tank captain has more power at their fingertips than the pharaoh did. The ability to do work, you know, with, you can enslave humans and have them do things, but I the engineers know there's a number. I don't know if it's above 100 or 50 or something. After 150, you can add another 500 people, but it doesn't increase the ability to do work because there's too many inefficiencies. People aren't pulling the right time. The force is directed improperly, whatever. But there's a limit to how much force you can get out of humans working together. And it's dwarfed by a bulldozer. And yet the pharaohs built the, you know, the pyramids and all those things. So again, a great teaching example to think about, you know, the world we live in, which is the conceit of the book, is that, you know, Ecclesiastes says there's nothing new under the sun. But McNeil says humans are something, our scale is something that's new under the sun, the impact of it. So really a fantastic book. Then I think the last one that I'll name, but of course there's more that one could talk about, James Webb's Humanity's Burden, which is about how human occupation interacted in creating malarias, especially falciparum malaria, as a plague on the planet. So it's the interaction of people and their settlements and the mosquitoes and this parasite synergistically created falciparum malaria and shaped, you know, humans shaped inadvertently how this disease operates. And so really a fantastic book thinking about not just disease as something that comes from somewhere else, but how things we do can help create those things. And in similar fashion, all these nice warm water pools that surround us create environments, and the mechanical things we use, like fans and blowers and things like that, create the field for Legionnaires' disease outbreaks.
Well, we talk about the creation of diseases and environments for them to spread. Maybe we'll bring this back to the film now.
Okay.
Our big question at the end of the night, is 12 Monkeys a history movie?
Yes. Yes, it is. Because, as I said, Bruce Willis is a historian. He's going back in time. You know, I kind of played around with this, and it's probably going too far. But now you've recently watched the film. He's got the set of scientists, right? In one way, I was thinking about it like Bruce Willis is either a graduate student on his master's or a PhD dissertation, in which there's a group that are saying, go out and get this information. And he doesn't always understand why he has to go and do these things. But he has to make that committee happy in order to get what he wants. That's maybe pushing it a little bit too far.
I feel like I need a trigger warning before we talk about the process of getting your PhD, but go on.
Yeah. So Bruce Willis goes, he's going back in time to study it, and he's warned not to fall in love with that dying world, that world that no longer exists. And he goes back with the intent of gathering information and understanding that will be useful for him or his committee in the present, but he can't change anything, right? He can't go back and shift things up. And then, of course, it's a history film because it gives us what concerned people or interested people or how they viewed the world in the mid-1990s, early 1990s.
That's awesome. George, where can people find you on the world, on the World Wide Web?
So I don't have any of the social media devices.
God bless you for that.
Yeah. Everyone is continually shocked that I rarely carry a cell phone, only when I'm traveling somewhere. But you can find me right here at Wichita State University on the homepage. I will respond to all emails and even random phone calls. I received a random phone call one time when I did, I think I was on MSNBC or something, and somebody called me from Louisiana because they had the same last name. Oh, I'm a Deaner too. Called me up at home. So
was he calling you from the future to check in?
Like, not as far as I know. He thought I was a shampoo company. There, that's a 12 monkeys joke.
That's awesome. All right, George, thank you so much for being here today. I was looking forward to this for the longest time. I'm so glad we could put this together.
Yeah. Thanks for the invite. And I'm sorry we're not sharing a beer together. I was trying to be studious here in my office and not smuggle a beer in. And the chair's office is locked with the slush fund of scotch. So.
I know the chair. I'm not afraid of the chair. So awesome. Thank you so much.
All right.
And that's a wrap here at Historians of the Movies podcast. Thank you so very much to our guest, George Deaner, for jumping in and talking about 12 Monkeys, talking about Philadelphia, and talking about what it was like to have to educate me as a student. Thank you, of course, to our also Wichita-bound producer, Fletcher Powell. Thank you, Fletcher, for being here producing this show. And most of all, of course, always thank you to you guys for continuing to support this podcast, for continuing to share with the world what we're doing here. If you're digging what we're doing, please do leave comments, leave ratings on Apple Podcasts, Spotify Podcasts. And if you're interested in sponsoring the pod, please let us know at historiansatthemovies@gmail.com. Guys, thank you so much for being part of this community. It is amazing that we are running on, almost 6 years now. So thank you so much for being here, being part of this. And we'll see you next week. Ciao for now. Bye.